The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Let's get to, we've got a great guest, and we're going to get a great perspective on what investors who have lots of money to put to work are most interested. Let's get right to it with Julian Salisbury, Global Head of Goldman Sachs Asset Management, with us on site at the Milken Global Conference. How are you?
Great, thank you.
So, the environment. People eager to put money up, a lot of things going on.
Look, we are in a record fundraising environment, a record capital deployment environment, and a record environment for monetizations from those same portfolios. So,
it's overwhelming the amount of money that is coming into the investment space at large.
If you look at alternatives, just the top five listed alternative managers raised, I believe, $153 billion last quarter.
It's crazy.
$440 billion of dry powder. That's 2x the amount of dry powder that existed 5 years ago. That being said, while that may seem overwhelming and concerning to some extent, the magnitude of the opportunity has also grown substantially. If you look at...
Explain that in terms of the options that are out there.
So, well, first of all, if you just look at M&A activity, we just had a $1.6 trillion quarter for M&A, the biggest quarter ever. That's five consecutive quarters of north of a trillion.
I just did a panel with global co-heads of Citi and Deutsche, and they said we're on track for like 4.1 globally, and they think it could be $5 trillion.
Nuts. I mean, and if you look at the share of that that's being prosecuted by sponsors, I mean, last year 31% was a record year for the share of M&A activity prosecuted through the private equity community.
Right.
This year it's running at 36%, so it's a higher percentage of a higher volume. I think that greater opportunity set is a function of a number of things. First of all, we had a pretty big pause last year where there was a dearth of activity for, really a six-month-plus hiatus of activity. And now off the back of that, if you look at the accelerating trends that were already taking place in the global economy, many of those trends were just accelerated by COVID. And now I think there's, in addition to the pause and the catch-up, there's a greater sense of urgency to transform your business, whether it be through M&A, through investment, through... through digital transformation of the business, and all of these things are leading to people wanting to raise capital.
But Julian, are you finding effective places to deploy all of that capital? We spoke to Scott Minard. We're going to air the interview in just a few minutes. He said this is a period of time where he looks across asset classes and things are so expensive, with the exception of residential real estate.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody about this earlier today. I can remember back as far as 20 years doing business planning. I've been at the firm for 23 years. I don't quite remember the first 3 years.
Why is that? Wait a minute.
Maybe I wasn't invited to business planning the first 3 years, but each and every year that I can remember, we sit every year, including, the end of 2009, when things were still pretty, like every year you sit there, how am I going to make money last year? Because when you look back, it always seems, it was so obvious with hindsight how you made money. It was never that easy. It was never that obvious. And I think it's true today. That being said, it is, valuations are particularly high on many metrics. Growth in particular, relative to value, is expensive on many metrics. But it's always more complicated than that. I look at take our Growth Equity Investment Committee. Every week, two to three companies come through that committee that are capable of being multi-billion dollar companies that didn't exist two, three, 4 years ago.
Right.
And some they won't all win. Some will not succeed. Some will go on to be worth tens of billions of dollars. And by most valuation metrics, traditional valuation metrics, frankly, don't really work when you're looking at these businesses. Any kind of near-term revenue multiple, earnings multiple, you really have to look at what's this company capable of becoming over the next 5 to 10 years,
right,
and taking a more forward-looking view. And I think that's another reason why more of this is being conducted in the private markets, where people are able to take a longer-term view, focus on things like unit economics.
Does it create healthier companies that ultimately do go public, whether it's through a direct listing, whether it's an IPO, a SPAC, because they're able to kind of incubate for longer periods?
Yeah, I think that, private markets are a great way for companies to scale and grow. The public market route is also a very valuable tool for capital raising
you
for companies.
You guys make money when companies go public. They,
and including raising money through traditional IPOs or SPAC.
Yeah.
There's no there's room for all of these things. Yeah. But I would say that the patience required to scale some of these businesses, the capital that's required to scale some of these businesses in the early instances, it probably is easier to prosecute that in private markets. And also, look, some of these companies are just this, they're often quite small.
Yeah.
They have a few senior entrepreneurs at the top of the, they need real kind of help and guidance and governance growing the businesses.
Hey, Julian, I'm wondering what the questions that the clients of Goldman Sachs Asset Management are coming to you with right now. What are
they
looking for?
Should I buy Dogecoin? Is that what they're asking you, Julian?
I'm not sure I'm going to comment on the value of any individual cryptocurrency.
No, but you know what I mean. There's some interesting trends out there.
Yeah, I think that everybody's struggling with this question of where to deploy capital. They can't make the returns that they need through traditional fixed income product. They look at equity markets, which have been and will continue to be a great source of return over the right time horizon. I always think there's a very large room in your portfolio for public equities. It's not all about private markets. But what they're looking for is ways to pivot into private markets as an alternative source to the lack of return that's really available in fixed income.
Just got about 25 seconds left here. What do you think is the investment people, maybe it's not on everybody's radar, but they should be watching closely, just quickly? I know. Don't say rowing. Don't say canoeing.
No.
Kayaking.
Oh, kayaking. Hurry up. Clock's ticking. Come on, Julian.
Okay. I think the transformation that's going to happen in real estate over the next 5 years is underappreciated.
Residential? Commercial?
All forms of real estate.
Nicely done.
Yeah, got to get you back.
Julian Salisbury, Global Head of Goldman Sachs Asset Management, right here on Bloomberg. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser along with Tim Stenovic here at the Milken Conference.
Well, earlier today, we spoke with Guggenheim Global CIO Scott Miner here at the Milken Institute Global Conference. It was a great conversation, and in this excerpt, Scott discusses market headwinds and bubbles. Check it out.
I have never seen a time like this where there is nothing that I can point to that I can call cheap. You know, historically, I remember being interviewed on Bloomberg in 2006 and telling the interviewer that the cheap thing was 10-year treasury notes at 5.25%. And they said, well, who would want 10-year treasury notes? Well, you know, I was concerned about the housing crisis. Today, I can't point to anything that I think that if we got ourselves into trouble, that would actually be cheap to buy today that has value. So you're left in this world, which I'm not real comfortable in, where you have to find things that are expensive that are probably going to become more expensive. And so, you know.
Such as?
Well, I mean, cryptocurrency, yeah. Right? You know, I mean, Shiba, if you invested in Shiba coin back in the first quarter of this year, $1,000 today would be worth $2.1 million, right? I mean, can I find another Shiba coin? I don't know, but...
Okay, but we're talking about something that a lot of people think is a joke.
Well, Shiba coin was a joke created to mimic Dogecoin, which was a joke, right? So,
do
I mean,
those cancel each other out.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's a second derivative joke or cryptocurrency, but you know, it just shows you how much cash is out there, how it's lifting asset prices. Like, I was asked at the Federal Reserve to do a thing on bubbles, and what markets did I think were in bubbles? And I went through every market I could think of, and the one I said, sports memorabilia is in a bubble. Baseball cards are clearly in a bubble, right? You look at stocks, right? Are they in a bubble? Well, not with interest rates where they're at.
And isn't it so much of it, Scott, kind of a bounce back from falling off a cliff and things recovering? Or do you think, no, we've done that and then we've done a little bit more?
Well, I think, you know, normally at this point in a recovery, I would say, we're kind of in the second or third inning, right? Like when the Dodgers are winning the World Series. But this is like we went right to the fifth inning. You know, the incredible rally that we've got coming out of the pandemic and the amount of stimulus. You know, people compare this to a war, right? The pandemic was a war. And so I've gone back and I've studied wars. And when you get, there is an interesting corollary, is when you have a major war like the First World War or the Second World War, right after the war is over and there's been all this stimulus from defense spending and money printing, you get a spike in inflation, which is transitory. So when people talk to me about, is this transitory? Which I'm always like, everything's transitory. Life is transitory. But is this something that is permanent, and should we be worried about it in the long run? And I think today the answer is no.
Well,
if you look at all the things that have gone up in price that are in the CPI components, you've got hospitality industry stuff, hotels, airlines, automobiles, right, which are due to the supply chain interruption. It's really a bounce back from what we had in the decline. Now you could say, well, wait a minute, Scott, autos. Well, look, the supply chain interruption to me looks like the retooling that occurred at the end of the Second World War, right? All output, auto plants, everything had been converted to wartime production. There was a transition period in the mid 40s. And during that transition period, people who had saved all this money from the stimulus from the war wanted to spend it, and so auto prices went up. But you know, what's interesting is there was one period in there, I think it was in 46 or 47, where inflation actually was at 20%, but bond yields never went above 2.25%.
Which doesn't quite make sense, does it?
Well, I think we're living in it today.
Ah, what a great way to wrap up that interview. Guggenheim Global Chief Investment Officer Scott Minard, well known to the Bloomberg audience. He caught up on a great panel with our own Scarlett Fu here at Milken, and he joined us earlier today to sit down. But I love how he looks at history and likens after the World War II to where we are today.
And I have
That's
to say,
some differences.
You know, if you were watching on YouTube, you probably saw my jaw dropped when he mentioned Dogecoin.
I
couldn't believe that word came out of his mouth.
But he's someone who, you know, he looks at all the different asset classes, tries to understand the relationships,
yeah.
And, you know, why is something, you know, going up, something going down, what's going on more broadly?
I think also he used it as a point to illustrate the exuberance that we're seeing in many different parts of the market right now.
Yeah. I'm not going to ask our own Charlie V about Dogecoin. No, it's not.
He's on set with us, helping us make sure that this broadcast is working. Thumbs up to Dogecoin, Charlie. Thumbs up. Okay.
Thumbs up. All right, check out that full interview. You can find that online and on the Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
All right. Well, she has been a longtime public service servant. We've been having a good conversation behind the scene. Former Labor and Transportation Secretary, worked in several administrations, the Reagan administration, President George W. Bush, President Trump. We welcome the Honorable Elaine Chao. So nice to have you here with us.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Well, it's interesting. You know, labor, transportation, I feel like these are the two hot topics right now. We're looking at, are there changes going on in the labor force? Will we never go back to levels in terms of the potential workforce that we saw pre-pandemic? Let's start there. What do you think? What are your observations of it?
Well, it's great to be here at the Milken Institute because these issues are being discussed. And I just came from a panel discussion with five large employers who are talking about what will be the work patterns of their employees in the future. They're taking polling more. They're asking their employees more. And clearly, some kind of hybrid working environment arrangement will be much more accepting to employees. And I think employers are trying to work this out.
Right.
And, you know, at first they were going to come back to work. The workforce was going to come back to work last September. Then it was last December. Then it was the spring. Then it was going to be September. And now people are talking about spring of 2022. So clearly we're all feeling our way as to how to come back at that.
But it's changed, right?
It has changed. I think it's changed. At least very much in the short term. It's greater flexibility. And this is going to present challenges to the labor laws. Because so much of the labor laws are over 70 years old, and they think about a workplace that is, you know, fixed and that has a 40-hour work week, people come to work.
Right.
And so all of that is going to change, and that's going to put tremendous impetus on changing the labor laws, which are traditionally very, very very, very difficult to change because you know, they're
structure.
So fraught with politics.
Yeah.
There is this imbalance happening, though, right now. When we look at the labor market, there is an oversupply of workers, and but they are not actually returning to the workforce. Do you think we ever get back to a workforce that looks like it looked before the pandemic? Like, is it realistic for us to think about
more,
it from those numbers?
Yeah, it's even more before the pandemic. When I was labor secretary, the labor participation rate was about 66%. With a workforce of about 157 million people.
Right.
And then we had the Great Recession. And then the labor participation rate dropped to about 63, and it kind of never recovered. Mm-hmm. And with the COVID then, it went from 63.3 or 4 down to 61.7, 61.1. So we're continuing to see declines in labor participation, which is terrible because we need these workers to come back to fuel a full recovery. But there's also another factor, another dynamic at play here, and that is the skills gap.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about this for years, Elaine.
Yes.
And I'm going to throw in another problem. We've been talking about infrastructure for years. How many administrations, right? And this is something that has had bipartisan support. What ultimately, from your perspective, do we have to start spending on when it comes to infrastructure?
Well,
look at the supply chains and the
I'm
problems.
For, obviously, investing in transportation infrastructure. The reason that the Trump administration was never able to succeed in the infrastructure proposal was because there was a big debate about whether there should be $1 for $1 of investment spending.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republicans believe that there can be leverage, that we can use public-private partnerships
right.
and leverage existing government dollars. And the Democrats felt that they wanted $1 for $1 deficit spending, which obviously the pros and cons to both. So we were never able to galvanize enough consensus around public-private partnerships. This time around, I think there's an infrastructure bill, a transportation infrastructure bill to be had. Unfortunately, now it's being held hostage to the budget reconciliation bill.
Right.
If it were to be stand alone, there is a deal to be made and passed on the infrastructure bill. And I'm hopeful that it would be passed before year end.
I feel like politics. I mean, I want to ask you, because you've been in politics for such
a long time. I'm not in politics. I am a public servant. I've always viewed myself as being in public service.
I did say you were a longtime public servant. The Republican Party, if I think about the January 6th Capitol riot, you resigned after that.
Yes, I did.
You left the Trump administration. You were there, almost to the end. Do you regret being part of that administration?
I'm very grateful for the opportunity to serve my country. I'm an immigrant to this country. I came when I was 8 years old. I didn't get my citizenship until 19. And it used to be that if the president asked, the only answer you can give is yes. I didn't know the president very well, but I also believe that the American people deserve to have a functioning government. But going back to the infrastructure bill, the real drama is on the Democrat side. Because as I mentioned, there is a bill to be had. There was bipartisan support. Republicans signed on to this infrastructure bill.
Right.
But the speaker, and she and I share a birthday, by the way.
Nancy
she's
Pelosi.
In a tough. Yes, she's in a tough spot.
Yeah.
Because she's got moderates who want to hold back on the spending.
Well,
she's got progressives that want to spend more. So she's trying to balance that.
Right.
But if left alone, that infrastructure bill can move on its own.
Many
so all the drama is on the Democrat side.
And you know this. You follow what's been going on in the economy, certainly in the pandemic. Milken covers this left and right, the inequities that we have seen. And it's not new. And there are people who have not shared in the wealth creation. And so that softer infrastructure that the president and his team are trying to get through, I mean, this is part of the battle. And
I think for those people that question that, they're not saying that these social infrastructure proposals are unworthy. What they're saying basically is, should they be included in what was originally going to be called a transportation infrastructure bill?
But you know
bill.
How politics works, that if, okay, we got infrastructure done, we're done.
So it was originally, the original infrastructure bill had only 6% of what is traditionally defined as transportation infrastructure. If you expand the explanation and the description a bit more generously, you get up to 30% of the dollars. But clearly, there's a need for transportation infrastructure. Roads, bridges,
right.
transit, ports, airports.
Drive around New York, right?
Absolutely.
I mean,
a governor got elected on this. I won't repeat her slogan.
We have to ask because we only have about a minute or so.
Yeah, I know you consider yourself a public servant, but we got to ask more politics.
Why?
Are you talking with Donald?
Yeah.
Have you heard from Donald Trump at all?
We have not spoken.
Not at all.
But I'm out of politics now.
You are, but you did
serve in
three.
I've always been in public policy.
You served in three administrations. Do you consider President Trump is the leader right now of the Republican Party?
Well, I think that is in the process of being decided and sorted out. There's still some time to go. There's 2022 coming up, and then there's 2024.
Should he be the leader of the Republican Party?
That's up to the people. You know, I think for those who wonder about his appeal, they should be asking, what is it that prompts so many Americans to support him? And I think that's a very, the answer will be very, very revealing.
And you,
and it's a teaching, you know, it's something that I think, you know, leadership should understand.
But as someone who came to this country as an immigrant and became a citizen, do you think, a voting citizen, that he should be president? Or should
well,
be the leader,
support,
should be leader of the Republican
well,
Party?
I will support the nominee. You, I mean, I'm a Republican, so I will support whoever the nominee is.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. I wish we had more time. You have such great energy. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And come at things from so many different perspectives. Elaine Chao, of course, former Secretary of Transportation, former Secretary of Labor. I remember talking to you years ago when the monthly jobs reports came out. So some great history. We've had another great day at Milken.
And it's only day two.
I know. We have one more day. And I'm going to talk to Kathy Wood in a few minutes.
All right. Go get ready for that.
This is Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.